This is Looking Forward, conversations about the future of work, brought to you by MillerKnoll.
Hey, everyone. It's no mystery that many organizations around the world are seeking to support new ways of working and that many are struggling to do so. But there are also excellent examples of organizations that have discovered new approaches and are finding success. Today, we'll kick off the season with two very insightful experts on the future of work to discuss what is and isn't working. The first is Annie Dean, Vice President of Team Anywhere at Atlassian. Team Anywhere is Atlassian's approach to supporting distributed working, and Annie is not only responsible for helping employees to work effectively across distances, but also for their corporate real estate portfolio. I've spent time in several of Atlassian's facilities, which I consider to be some of the best offices that I've ever experienced. And I think that Atlassian's approach to supporting new ways of working is years ahead of most organizations. Joining Annie is Matt Boyle, who's a senior reporter at Bloomberg News. And Matt's one of the people who created Bloomberg's WorkShift. That's their vertical reporting on new ways of working. Matt has covered a wide range of topics in his reporting and is one of the most knowledgeable and thorough reporters covering the future of work in the world. Together, we'll discuss what both Annie and Matt are seeing in the world of work and how organizations like Atlassian are forging new ground that can help us all imagine a better way of supporting work. So let's dive right in. Hey, Annie and Matt, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having us.
Good morning. Thank you.
I'm super pleased to be spending some time with both of you talking about work and workplace, but let's start this out by allowing you to share a little bit about yourselves with our listeners. Maybe I can start with you, Annie.
I'd love to. Thanks for having me, Ryan. I've been really looking forward to this conversation. I'm Annie Dean. I'm the head of Team Anywhere at Atlassian, and that means that I'm responsible for our shift to becoming a distributed first company. I've been in this space since 2016. Ryan and I have known each other for years prior to the pandemic, which I feel like is always special, you know, in our crew of people who have been trying to make remote happen all these years. And it's been very cool to be able to see the way the world has been changing over the past couple of years, and grateful for the chance to talk about it today.
Awesome. I'm glad you're here. Matt?
I'm Matt Boyle. I'm a senior reporter for Bloomberg News. And for the past year and a half or so, I've been part of a brand new editorial vertical at Bloomberg called WorkShift, which is taking a look at the future of work, or actually, or usually the messy present of work, and management trends as well. And obviously, new ways of working, remote, hybrid, are very much a part of that. I've been a business journalist for, my God, 25 years, most of that spent in New York, with 5 years also over in London. And I've worked for Bloomberg about 13 years. Earlier in my career, I was with Businessweek magazine, which was then bought by Bloomberg. And before that, with Fortune magazine.
Awesome. And I've had the privilege of being able to work with you on some pieces. I always appreciate how thorough you are and that you actually want to get into the meat of what you just described as the messy present. I like that term. Let me just start with you, Matt. Help us unpack a little bit in your work of what you've seen in terms of what may be working or challenges that organizations are having in terms of supporting new ways of working at this point in time.
Yeah, well, it's funny. I opened the New York Times today. I opened the New York Times like we still read newspapers, but I clicked on the New York Times today to find that Paul Krugman, of all people, was talking about remote work. He finally discovered that it's a thing, I guess. The New York Times has realized that maybe remote work isn't going away and they might have to write a column about it. But he did make an interesting point. He said remote work, or working from home, he called it an infant industry that learns by doing. And it's not a bad phrase, actually. We are learning by doing here. This whole pandemic experience has been like, you know, everybody's job has been put in a petri dish, and people are experimenting on us, whether it's you, Ryan, looking at different ways of how are your clients going to work best, or if it's CEO saying, well, what if I just shifted everyone to 4 days in the office? What will happen there? What's interesting, though, is that, yes, the interesting stories for us lie in what's working, but also usually more often what's not working. That's where the lessons are learned, right? I mean, I know companies often don't want to talk about what's not working, but that is where the stories and the lessons certainly lie. I mean, one thing we do know, Ryan, is that one size does not fit all. One size misfits all, which is what a very smart person told me last week in an interview. I mean, what we know, obviously, that the demand for talent has not gone away. Despite all these news about layoffs and headlines, it is still a very, very tight labor market. So what else do we know? We know some people can work productively at home, but others either can't or shouldn't, right? And despite all this discussion around we have to be back in the office because of culture and because of collaboration, let's remember that for a lot of people, they've been alone for 2 years in their own little hybrid COVID cocoon and have a very heightened sensitivity to how close they are to each other. So it's one thing to throw Matt Boyle back into a loud, noisy newsroom with 50 people around him shouting at sources and, you know, all this noise in my ear. I'm used to that, but a lot of people are not. So personal space is becoming much more important. Acoustics. I was at an office yesterday. I was taking a look at actually office furniture, Ryan. We can talk about this later, but I saw a lot of phone booths and a lot of those personal spaces where people just go to hide away and say, well, why would you schlep all the way to an office when your boss has told you that it's all about collaboration and you spend 2/3 of the day in a soundproof phone booth? Well, you have to respect that. That's the way of working right now. I think the bottom line, Ryan, is sort of COVID is like, if you don't recognize that COVID was a portal that we walked through, you're going to fail here. You know, we're not going to undo this and just sort of hope that it's going to go back and flip the page back to 2019. So how do we take everything we learned over the past 3 years about the employee experience and sort of translate that into new knowledge and this new talent pool that we're dealing with, whether it's Gen Z, Gen X, baby boomers as well, let's not forget. And so looking at all that and not just coming out and saying, well, we've done all the research and it's got to be 4 days in the office, folks. That's the way it'll be. That is the worst way to go about it. So that's some of the things I've picked up on anyway. And I'm sure Annie can build on that.
Yeah, I love also, Matt, I haven't seen Krugman's article yet, but it's time for The Economist to start seriously talking about remote work. So I'm glad that we're starting to build that platform. And I think where we are in the conversation is a very interesting thing to reflect on. Because like you said, so much of the conversation over the past couple of years has been dominated by what executives are going to quote unquote give to their employees. It's very focused on where people are located, thinking about this as an entitlement. But really, this is a different way to do business. And the faster we get to that conversation, the better off we're all going to be. So I think where I'd love to see the conversation begin to shift is, what does well-executed distributed work look like? How does it impact businesses? How does it result in a better business model? How does it change the way that we pursue the way work gets done so that we can lead to better innovation and meet the challenges of our time? And how does it result in changes in society? And I think all of those things are really important conversations that we're not quite pulling the threads on yet. And when I think about this, it's like, I would love people to stop talking about, is it going to be 3 days in the office or is it going to be 4 days in the office? And I'd love to start talking about what distributed work really is. It's not about where people are located. It's the idea that a modern company operates by distributing information across a well-connected network. And that requires different ways of working. So we used to distribute information across our networks because we all sat next to each other. But now we need new ways of doing it. We need new ways of working. And I think we're coming into that era where, unsurprisingly, half of the market is trying to spin all the way back. They're trying to say, oh, this didn't work. It's a failed experiment. Bring everyone back. We're never going to be able to collaborate unless we get everyone sitting side by side. But any smart person knows that no company is operating like that today. We are running global companies. We've been running global companies since the 1980s and 1990s. So I'm really looking forward in the next couple of years, and this podcast is aptly named, to really think about what are those ways of working and the new management principles that are going to help us actually run companies in the way that they need to be run with the technology that already exists to facilitate it so that we can keep moving forward. Because like you said, Matt, we're not going back. So let's stop pretending we are.
For me, you put your finger on it, Annie. Like, distributed working is a much richer topic than maybe just talking about remote or in the office, because work's been spreading out since we got Wi-Fi and organizations are becoming more distributed. So for a lot of organizations that I talk to, I think the issue is what does it look like to manage a workforce that's in lots of different locations, whether they're in a home or an office on a given day may actually be the secondary concern. But a lot of people don't know what it looks like to manage a team that's highly spread out and try to keep them, you know, working in a cohesive way.
Yeah.
One of the things, Ryan, that surprised me most when it was, I think it was one of the early Future Forum surveys back when it was like a new thing. I was like, what is this Future Forum and what are they telling us? And I know obviously you guys were involved in that, Ryan, was the finding that as much as people wanted flexibility around where they worked, which of course has become the big battle, are you in the office or are you home? And if you're home, you're lazy and selfish. And if you're in the office, you're going to get that promotion, Johnny. But actually, one of the early Future Forum surveys found that it was when people worked, the time flexibility, the scheduling flexibility that was even more important to them early in COVID. I remember that hitting me and saying, okay, things have really changed here and maybe we're focusing on the wrong thing. Again, not that where you are is not important, but, and as you guys have said, we've been doing this for a long time, you know, Wi-Fi and mobile phones freed us up to do this, but in terms of it becoming really widespread, certainly for me as a journalist, it was unheard of. I had no home setup whatsoever. I worked remotely, but I was at, let's say, doing an interview. I was at a factory. I was talking to a CEO, but, you know, I wasn't badging in, for example. So yeah, this sort of whole sense of when work happens being just as important as where it happens is one thing that's really, I think I've embraced certainly throughout this.
We just got some interesting data on this, which is we've looked at usage patterns of our internal tools like Confluence and Jira and our other work management tools, both for ourselves and for our customers. And we've done this now for 3 years running. And what we've seen post-pandemic is that the length of the day has really increased. So it's kind of like it's a 10-hour day, but there are breaks in the middle of it. So we're seeing that people are logging in and logging out earlier and later than they might otherwise have, but the intensity of the product usage in the middle of the day goes down because they go for a run, they go pick up their kids at school. And I think that really speaks to the story of the idea that when people work is shifting as a result of this change. And then similarly, we looked at customers who have embraced the idea of distributed work less than we have internally. And we see that those days look much more consistent and with traditional work days. So, you know, we're not seeing any breaks in the middle. We're not seeing that flexibility happen. And it tends to be a more standard work day. And who knows, right? Like, who knows what the right answer is? I think we all have to stay curious. But I love the idea that people can embrace a better quality of life in the context of their work day, because why not? But also, you know, Atlassian is a very global company working across many different time zones. So being able to shift when work is happening and really optimize the connection points with the different teammates that you're seeking to collaborate with is a great advantage for us as a company. So really interesting to see it play out.
Andy, can I ask, in that data you mentioned, did you see three peaks of productivity? Like, I think it was Microsoft's data from a while ago that had the morning peak, of course, and then maybe the post-lunch peak of productivity. And then, of course, the new one, which they discovered, which everyone was oohing and aahing about, was the sort of 9:30, 10 p.m. sort of mini peak of productivity, which, of course, was a lot of either parents who had finally gotten the kids down to sleep and were able to answer that email from 10 hours ago, but also maybe people who just prefer to work in those hours. Did you see that as well in your data?
We saw, I would say, something similar, not exactly the same conclusion, but I think that what Microsoft is seeing is really great. And also, I think Microsoft, by the way, is doing the best research out there on this topic. I love when I see them publish new pieces. I also think that there's an interesting weekend trend where people are embracing a little bit more weekend work, which in the past, I would say that's a bad thing. But if it's enabling you to take bigger breaks and pick up your kids at school, I think that is an interesting and fair trade-off. So that's interesting to see as well.
Yeah, it's one thing if it's enabling to take the kids somewhere. The problem, though, is if you're doing that weekend work because it's the only time you're not getting 97 pings of notifications from Slack and everything.
One of the things we learned with the Future Forum work is that when people were craving more schedule flexibility, sometimes it wasn't so much their working hours, it was control over their calendar. And in particular, the dominance of video meetings throughout the day was so limiting to them that it made me wonder a little bit, Annie, as you were talking about some of those use patterns, I would love to think that people are going for a run or walking the dog in the middle of the day. It also made me wonder if people are simply stuck on those video calls in those booths that Matt described.
Yeah.
And doing more individual creative or asynchronous collaboration in other parts of the day because their calendar's filled with too many meetings.
I mean, God, the tyranny of the 30-minute Zoom is just something, I don't know what we're going to do about it, but I mean, we've all been in those meetings where it's 29 minutes is up and you're actually finally flowing and stuff is happening. And then, oh, okay, this meeting, you know, it's over now. Whatever we were talking about is ended. And then, of course, you know, maybe some people are in the office and can continue the conversation, but then the virtual people, of course, will feel, okay, wait a minute, this was just getting, you know, we're just sort of finalizing some stuff or making some decisions and we hit the 30-minute mark. So everyone's already losing interest, right? And they're thinking about the next meeting. So the cost of those is finally something we're putting some dollar figures past, and we've written some fun stories on the cost of these useless meetings. It's insane.
We have this hypothesis about something that we're calling document-led collaboration. I mean, it's not a totally new idea, but it's not consistently embraced. And it's the idea that you use documents to either facilitate or replace many synchronous touch points. And what that does is it creates a huge amount of clarity because it's harder to write things down than it is to casually throw it together in a meeting. It gives everyone the same access to that information. You can distribute the information to collaborators more effectively. But in order to do document-led collaboration well, you have to have a lot more time because it takes time to sit down and think through how to clearly articulate your viewpoints or facilitate a decision. And you have to be able to go and get the information, for instance, as you synthesize it into a document work product. And so one of our hypotheses is that people should have basically 50% of their calendar free for asynchronous and focused work. And we've been running experiments on my team, the Team Anywhere organization, and people love it. So what it does is every week we kind of have a prioritization exercise, and I have my leaders do this with their direct reports as well and say, you know, these are the things that matter. If there are things on your calendar that don't matter, you have to take them off because you need to focus on producing the asynchronous focused work that's ultimately going to lead our big outcomes faster because you can't get anything of value done in 30 minutes. And then I ask them to say, now take that time. So you now that you have 50% of your day free, one, you can do more focused work, but two, you can put together the meetings that are important to you. So I tell them to do meetings for only a couple of different reasons: to solve a complex problem, to be creative, to drive momentum, or to genuinely connect with somebody. And this kind of eliminates most 30-minute meetings because to be creative, I tell them, you got to meet for 90 minutes. You might need to actually meet for 90 minutes or 2 hours every single day for a week. And that's the way you're going to get to the ideation that's necessary to come up with the creative solution. If it's momentum that we're driving, I'm like, you need to look your partners in the eye every single day. And you might need to only do that for 15 minutes per day, but that's what's going to drive the momentum. So with the tool that I'm trying to give my team is think more creatively about time as an asset. Recognize that synchronous time is the thing that holds us all back, but also is the only thing that pushes us forward. So you've got to use that time in the most effective way possible. We're looking to study it now to see, like, is there a there? How's our hypothesis playing out on the synchronous time and also on document-led collaboration? So that's research that we're doing now, but it's been really exciting. And I got a call from somebody who's many layers down in the organization from me. And she said, I just want to tell you that now that you've asked us to work all differently, the entire team is being more creative. They're being more innovative. They're not thinking about just doing business as usual. They're taking solutions and doing things in a different way. And I was like, well, you don't know that I'm trying to build this thesis about how to work differently overall. So thank you for giving me this huge proof point that it's not even just about the work that's at hand, but also the way that we approach work that can be disrupted by doing things differently. So I wonder if you think those are there.
How do you spread that throughout an entire organization? It's one thing for you to give your team permission to say no to meetings, but other managers love meetings.
Yeah.
Because if they're not holding meetings, they don't feel they're in charge of anyone. So it's one thing for Team Anywhere at Atlassian to say, okay, guys, we're going to work differently. I mean, I would hope you guys are doing that, but try telling that to JPMorgan Chase or to someone at a, let's say, more traditional company, or just taking it throughout Atlassian. You know, you are going to maybe encounter some resistance to people who are like, well, these meetings are set, right? And if we're not holding meetings, then we're not getting stuff done. So what do you think is the biggest challenge to sort of getting that message spread throughout? I mean, that person who called you up and gave you that testimonial, that's one great proof points, but I imagine you're going to need some data actually to spread this around.
Well, so you've hit the nail on the head that data, well, you've hit two nails on the head. One, this is not easy. And two, data is the only way to influence anyone. So the way that we're doing it internally is we're actually rolling these things out in sort of test units, and we're studying those teams. That's our intent. Right now we've been studying our organization, but we're hoping to expand it to more teams internally and experiment with what works. And also our team might not have the right answer. There's a lot more to be discovered here. But a couple of things. In terms of taking an innovative organization like Atlassian and continuing to make change, it's not without its challenges, because we have a lot of amazing, talented business leaders who grew up in a different way of working. And so asking people to do things in a fundamentally different way is challenging, even for the most creative and flexible and innovative among us. I will say some of the things that we've done, I've seen really get adopted very quickly. Our founders often kind of like take a new tool, like Loom, for instance, and they just start using it, and then everyone starts using it. So I think having kind of organizational norms and an organizational approach to doing things differently does yield faster adoption of new stuff. But I think what people are lacking overall, Atlassian and every other company like Atlassian, is we just don't have shared organizational norms about how to work in this environment yet, because we haven't yet gotten through the design phase of what it looks like to do distributed work really well. So let's say that's possible, right? Ryan, I see your hand up. What do you think?
Sorry, I just wanted to jump in and say, I think, of course, I'm biased, but I think Atlassian's taken a far more progressive approach to supporting distributed working than
totally
almost any other organization I can think of, including the design of your spaces. Can we just go back for a second? I know that in late 2020, Atlassian made some really significant changes in how you support work. Tell us a little bit about that and tell us about your team, because it really is, I think, very unique compared to most other organizations.
Yes, we are very lucky because our founders are very progressive and innovative and committed to this kind of new future, which is why I work at Atlassian. But the idea is that when 2020 came around and everyone called everyone to work from home, they very quickly recognized that this was a permanent shift and embraced what we now call Team Anywhere. And the idea is that every single person can choose where they work every single day. 40% of our company works more than 2 hours from a corporate office. So it's a pretty significant percentage of our company that is not located near an office at all. We have a number of other principles and beliefs that help power the program. But when we think about why we're doing it, it's because we want to be able to get the best talent from everywhere in the world. We believe that having a flexible employee experience is going to lead to better work outcomes. And we also believe that as the people who are building the tools that power distributed work, we better make sure that we're testing this internally and learning for it so we can always stay one step ahead of our customers and offer our customers the best product experience possible. And so it's been really interesting to see the way that Atlassian has committed to this. I run an organization that includes our workplaces. So I oversee all real estate, all workplace experience. I have a research team that looks at ways of working. I have an operations team whose goal it is to transform our different operating principles related to distributed work, like the idea that we have benefits that supports remote work, to implement those things into the business over a transformational period. And it's been really exciting to see this come together. It's a pretty sizable organization compared to other folks that are pursuing this work. I've now done this work in the enterprise level at 3 different companies, at Deloitte, at Facebook, and at Atlassian. And Atlassian is by far the most committed, and I think running the most committed and progressive organization in order to make this happen. So it's been very cool to be able to do this work from my seat. And I would say one of the things that is missing from many companies' approach is that they don't have a me. They don't have anyone really thinking this through. And therefore, it's hard to be anything other than reactive. And I get that.
Well, knowing that a lot of our listeners are involved in corporate real estate, facilities, workplace strategy, interior design. I think many might be surprised that you haven't, as a result of this embrace of distributed work, shut down all your offices. In fact, I was in your Austin office just a couple of weeks ago, truly one of the best spaces I've ever been in. Tell us about the effects of this approach on your offices and your approach to real estate.
Well, again, what I love about our executive team is they're so strategic and willing to think about things in a new way. So I didn't get that anxious call from our CFO or CEO saying, hey, I think we've got to close all of our offices. I think our executive team has always been very committed to the idea that offices are this unique cultural temple and a great experience for those who want to work in an office. Like Matt said, it's not one size fits all. Some people are in the office every single day. Some people never come to the office. And so when we thought about our offices and how to continue to support them, we knew we needed to evaluate business performance of an office. Like, what is the purpose of an office in this environment? And we agreed that the purpose is connection and that the secondary purpose is the ability to, excuse my swear word, but get shit done. And that means that you come to the office for connection, but you need to be supported to get shit done whenever you're there. And by the way, we ran an observational study that looked at all of our individualized spaces, like our phone booths, as well as our medium-sized conference rooms and our large-sized conference rooms. And we could tell, even as attendance was quite low just after we reopened, and found that our individual spaces were way oversubscribed, whereas our 4 to 6 person spaces were way undersubscribed. So that's a great proof point as we continue to design that people are looking for individual work as their anchor work in the new paradigm of office. But when we thought about business performance, we wanted to look at it in a new way. So we created a new set of metrics. We looked at cost per visit. So how much does it literally cost every time somebody visits the office pre-pandemic and post-pandemic? We looked at some key information on all of our visitors. We defined a local visitor as somebody who lives within 2 hours of the office. And we started to understand what percentage of our visitors is coming from that local community and what percentage of our visitors is coming from outside the local community because they're traveling for a team gathering. So for instance, in Austin, more than 90% of the local community is coming into the office every single month. And we feel really good about that. That's an engaged community. In New York, more than 50% of our visitors are coming from out of town for team gatherings because it's really well situated to airports. It's a nice local area. We don't have as big a presence on the East Coast. So, you know, people are a little bit more scattered on the East Coast. So it's a great centralizing point. So that helps us design our New York office with that type of gathering in mind. And that's the type of refinement we make over time. And so it's really led us to look at, okay, are people actually coming to the office? Is this delivering on connection for us? Because nobody has to come. But 76% of our community of Atlassians are coming to the office every quarter. We're seeing really strong local penetration rates of all of our various local communities. So what we know is that offices are really working for us. And we just had to be creative about how to go about understanding that so we could make the right strategic refinements over time, as opposed to kind of like throwing our hands in the air and saying offices don't work.
Yeah. Matt, what's one of the things that's standing out to me as I listen to Annie is just how good of working relationship and cooperation it appears that the leaders of Atlassian have with Annie's team and the employees. One of the themes that we continue to hear is just about the rising tensions between leaders and employees and different ways of working, in particular with return to office mandates. Is that something you're still seeing as you investigate different approaches to workplace? Or are we seeing some of those tensions hopefully easing and moving towards what Andy's describing?
Tensions are totally eliminated, right? Because once Elon said that remote work was morally wrong, who would ever take issue with that, right? I mean, no, I'm sorry, joke, Ryan, but yeah, tensions are aflame, let's say. And it's not just tensions between the rank and file and bosses. I imagine there's tensions in the C-suite. I think Annie said in something in her reply that I noticed, she said real estate reports to her. I don't want to get that wrong, Annie, but it sounds like it does. And that's not the case for a lot of organizations. So if real estate is not reporting up to a role like Annie's, you're going to have some headbutting in the boardroom between maybe the CHRO who's saying, guys, we got to work differently, and the head of corporate real estate, who let's say maybe is a little bit more risk averse. Somebody told me the other day when a corporate real estate leader gets a black eye, it lasts for a decade. meaning you're stuck in a 10-year lease. Everyone's going to remind you about that horrible 10-year lease for, you know, the rest of that term. And it creates this culture of risk aversion. So when we talk about, oh, the workplace is a lab, we're all experimenting. Well, no, not everyone's experimenting because you're getting a lot of resistance from certain quarters. So I think it's great that you are starting to see a real estate report into a CHRO or a chief people officer in many cases, but that's not often the case. Sometimes it's still reporting into the CFO. And for the CFO, especially nowadays, it's belt tightening time, folks. It's the year of austerity. And certainly that's going to lead probably to less of a real estate footprint, but it's also going to lead to less of a willingness to sort of maybe try new things, some of the things that, Annie's talking about here. I mean, the way I'm trying to look at it, and someone made this point to me, so I'm going to borrow a phrase. This person said, we are all now consumers of the office. And just as our consumer tastes change, you know, my preference in jeans and shoes has changed over time, what people want in a workplace is obviously going to continue to change depending on their age and more importantly, what stage they are in their life. The problem is for years, we designed offices like people were potted plants. There was no flexibility. We just sat there all day. And whether it was sitting in a boring cubicle or sitting in the rack'em and stack'em benches and rows that we still have in a lot of places, cough, cough, that's still the case. And what about a little bit of, you know, adding a little bit of sense of people are going to move around during the course of the day. For part of the day, they want to be in a phone booth and then they want to be in a collaborative space and then they want to grab a coffee. So knowing that they're not just coming and plopping down and staying in one place is kind of important. So maybe view employees as consumers of your office and it might lead to some new ideas.
You know, it's interesting just to react to a couple of those points. Challenges that I've seen as I've worked through this work in many different areas, right? Because I have to partner with so many different business units in order to drive this transformation and also particularly in real estate. But real estate has been a BAU function for a long time. It's lease, design, release, operate, right? And what we're saying now is, the intent of the product that we're building is completely different. It serves a totally different purpose. And you have to get people to snap out of their BAU mentality and really think about things differently. And I have seen such innovation on my team and such willingness to do that. But that's not an easy transition to make because that's, like you said, not how this has been incentivized. It's been about risk and delivery of a well-worn corporate brand experience. For instance, one change that we had to make, one of the teams I oversee is real estate design and development, and the other is workplace experience. And workplace experience is aptly named because in the 2010s, we had to go from people sitting in cubicles, not quite cubicles, but you know what I mean, people sitting in desk farms to creating a really cool corporate campus experience, a cool workplace experience. And now I have to say to my leaders, it's no longer your job to make a good experience. Your job is to proactively connect people. And that requires a totally different set of experiments, a totally different set of designs, and to snap out of the mentality of, oh, we're creating a great experience. People walk in and feel good, to make sure that every time Susie walks into the office, that we maximize the number of connection points she accrues during the day. How do you do that? Like, that's the new challenge. And that's not easy. That's a big shift.
No, because it's easier just to spend $80,000 on bagels. And I didn't just make that.
Exactly.
I did not make that number up. Somebody told me that at a client, just spending $80,000 on bagels just to get people in the office. And they recently realized maybe it wasn't having the right effect. And, oh, wow, there's a nice little item on the P&L we can take away. And so they got rid of the $80,000 in bagels. But it just left me shaking my head. I was like, are you kidding? This is still the answers we're coming up with.
Oh, I get that a lot. I hear a lot of what amenities will get people in the office. And it usually starts with, well, I think connection with other people will get them in the office first, as you point out, Annie.
What about enjoying your job? Yeah, and getting something out of it. I mean, all the bagels in the world aren't going to change the fact that you hate your boss, right?
So, Annie, I think this is coming up on my 30th or 29th or 30th year in the industry. I got to say, the Atlassian headquarters in Sydney is probably my all-time favorite space I've ever visited. Incredibly progressive. In particular, I think biophilic design. I mean, there's just tons of the outdoors moving in. You're working on a new headquarters in Sydney. I'm curious how the last few years have changed your approach or where you're headed with that new facility in the future.
It is the coolest building. I'm the daughter of an architect. I feel so grateful to be able to be part of this project. The exteriors were designed by shop architects here in New York, and we are just now building out the kind of interior workplace design program. And it's interesting because we have had the intent and we've been moving in this direction for a number of years now. But of course, during those years, we've had this big disruption of how to think about what workplace design should really look like. And just yesterday, I was looking through AR models. It was so cool. I was using my just iPhone to look at an AR model as if I had the actual architectural model on my desk. So lots of fun things to play with, even when you're doing a building site over in Sydney. The things that are really cool about that project is a huge focus on sustainability. It is the largest timber construction building in the world. And we do that because of the way that we can better manage our carbon footprint that way. Of course, it yields all sorts of interesting fire approvals, et cetera, and unique design challenges. And we haven't fundamentally changed our approach. We remain very, very committed to that project. We're so excited about it. It's super motivating. We were actually just talking yesterday about how to give more people in the company access to what that office is going to look and feel like. It is very much indoor-outdoor. It has operable windows across the entire exoskeleton. It has recessed habitats or neighborhoods inside an all-glass exoskeleton. And within that recessed footprint, there's tons of biophilia. So it's very much about like a park-like experience with these more intimate and customized spaces in the interior that can be used for many different reasons. So we haven't laid out the footprint to say, oh, there's going to be X number of individual spaces versus conference room spaces. But we do know we'll optimize for connection. Individual work will be the anchor point. We will be very focused on bringing teams together from across the world. So having a lot of larger scale conference and social spaces will make sure that the technology, by the way, Matt, you were saying we used to be designed for a completely different world. One of the challenges that we have, even in the beautiful office that you visited in Austin, Ryan, is that the workplace technology approach used to be that you give people Wi-Fi access where they sit. And now we've had to totally overhaul systems to make sure that all access is fundamentally mobile. So in Austin, we have a power grid that's underneath the floor and can be, you can basically plug into the floor almost anywhere so that you can configure a mobile sort of conference room setting anywhere in the open space. And those are the types of considerations and experiments that will inform what our Sydney office looks like in the future. And we have this amazing developer partner, Dexis, who is the largest developer in Australia. And the CIO there and I are always talking about how do we make this design flexible? Because it's not going to be ready until 2027. And the world is going to change a lot between now and then. So how do we preserve the opportunity to make the right choices so that we don't accidentally choose the, you know, Wi-Fi system that only follows an individual sitting in one space and make sure that we can do the most progressive thing as we get closer to launch? So it's a very cool project.
Well, I think we'll still need plants in the office in 2027, though. So that's a good focus.
It's true. Yes, I totally agree with you there. And lots of cool audio management that's been mentioned on this call. We've been doing a lot of pumping white noise through our systems to give people a little bit better sense of privacy because there are more sort of open air conversations happening in the office these days, as opposed to these closed door conversations in conference rooms of the past.
Are you doing anything with colors? I think it was Adobe who told me that one of their new offices, they've looked a lot about this, setting the tone of a certain rooms with different colors. I don't know if that's been something that you've looked at.
Interesting. I would say I have been less familiar with the idea of incorporating colors, but I do think that the thing that's really impactful about the new Sydney office is just the mixed media and the natural materials. So it's basically the entire interior is wooden. And yes, the structure itself is timber, but also these interior habitats are these beautiful exposed wood. So you kind of have like glass, steel, wood, and it leads to this very warm feeling that is more home-like as opposed to the offices of the past that are linoleum and cost-saving fiberboard type materials. This feels really sensual is kind of the word I'm looking for.
You're going to have an influx of employees migrating and moving to Sydney to deal with that.
Well, Matt, you mentioned Adobe, and they have done some, as you would expect, some really amazing things with color. I'm curious, in all of your work Have you found other examples of organizations that you think are beginning to move past all these challenges, or just good practices that maybe you think other organizations could learn from in terms of supporting work in new and better ways?
I mean, some are. I hesitate, Ryan, to sort of give the good housekeeping seal of approval to company A, B, or C. You know, it can end up getting people in trouble later on. Sam Bankman-Fried, Forbes 30 under 30. But I mean, what's interesting, I think, in terms of what's needed, I think, which is one maybe underlying your question. I think a new era of leadership is probably overdue. I mean, we know a lot of corporate leaders stayed throughout the pandemic because they said, I got to see this ship to port. I'm not going to leave in the middle of this, and are now finally sort of gone through that. And I kind of wonder if this really is going to require a new generation. And I don't just mean younger leaders. I just mean people with a different sort of point of view, or people who are really embracing a lot of this data that we're seeing, and more of it is coming out every day. 2 years ago, all we had was the Kastle index of office occupancy. And now I've got a half a dozen office occupancy data providers throwing me stuff, and I'm sort of drowning in it. But I don't mind drowning in the data as long as it's good data and it's telling us something, it's pointing us somewhere, rather than just in this inflammatory rhetoric and this horrible black and white way that we've laid out the work. Either you're in or you're out. It's wrong or it's right. No, there's nuance, of course. We are nuanced people. We contain multitudes, right? So figuring all that out might require just people who have really learned a lot during the pandemic and embraced what they learn, rather than those who would just really want to turn the page back. So I think that's one thing it's definitely going to require. And whether it's at a bank or a tech company or a retailer, it really doesn't matter. But we also like CEO changes because they make great stories as well and give us lots to write about too. But I do think that's one thing that's hopefully maybe we're going to see here is some people stepping aside who may have done a wonderful job of seeing their companies through the pandemic. But let's see what the next generation can do.
Let's roll with that a little bit. Annie, if you got a chance to sit down with a CEO, and maybe it's a CEO that's just decided that it's time for her or him to lead differently, what sort of practical advice would you give as far as a starting point to move beyond some of the traditional tropes or mindsets that we see so often cropping up in some of the stories that Matt and others share with us?
First of all, Matt, I just love your points. I think that it's time to think differently. And this is, I think what you just shared, Matt, reflects some of the experience I've had where you have to get people to think about their business differently in order to drive them in the direction of building well-executed distributed companies. Because the reward centers that we had and the way that we were doing work, it's all got to change. And a lot of people are motivated and energized by that. And a lot of people think that that is irrelevant and bad form. So again, like the only way to convince them is to show them the data about why and how it works. And that's why in this next phase, we've got to start having deeper conversations about data that points us forward instead of data that measures what we've lost looking back. And I don't think that enough people are asking the right questions to measure the opportunities going forward. So that's one thing that I would love to see. I sort of mentioned this at the beginning of our call, but I think that there are three things that every executive needs to understand. And I don't know that by saying them, I can get them to understand. I think this is a show don't tell world, and we've got to just keep showing what it looks like through data over time. But the first thing that they need to understand is that whether or not you have every single person in your company sitting in an office together, you are a modern company that requires distributed ways of working. So you've got to get your information across your network. Like, that is your company today. And unless you embrace modern work in a real way, and modern work is still being defined, you're not going to be able to compete in the future. So that's one thing. Regardless of where your employees sit, you better start working differently. That's point number one. Point number two is that if you do want to let your employees sit in different places, if you do want to embrace what I would call location diversity, you can run a tighter ship. You can spend less money on real estate and still deliver a great experience. You can support employees in many different parts of the world and across the US and different areas of the country. And you can have tighter unit economics. And that could be really good for your business. The third thing is that even if you don't believe me on one and two, it's better for society. This is better for families. This is better for women. This is better for people who have been traditionally disenfranchised from the workforce. And that's real. So I tend to not lead with that one because executives don't gravitate to as much. They don't necessarily see it as their responsibility. But one of my favorite recent quotes is by my friend, Darren Murph, who said he was the head of remote at GitLab and many people associate him with this landscape. And he was like, when we look back in 150 years and the world is very different than it is today, we're not going to look at this time as a time when work changed. We're going to look at this time as a time when life changed. And it's the different ways of working that powered that shift in the way that we approached our life. And I totally agree with that. Society is going to look different in the future. And it's going to be in part because people have redefined their relationship with corporations and the way that work gets done. And I feel good about that. So those are three things that I would love every executive to understand, but I think it's a long road to be able to get there. And I think the national and global conversation has to change in order to be able to have those nuanced conversations. I don't know, Matt, what do you think?
Well, we are seeing some signs of that. And we have a story out today about how we all talked about the global she session, the millions of women who left the workforce during the pandemic. Participation rates for women have just surpassed a peak that we last hit in 2000, according to government data. So basically, there's more companies have more women on the payrolls than ever before. Now, you want to hope that a lot of that is due to companies being more flexible and willing to hire moms. There's, you know, some great organizations around Working Moms Project and others that are doing a lot of good work with companies here. It's certainly a recovery, though, and how it plays out, of course, whether these women are working at a big global employer or whether they are entrepreneurs, it varies. And again, those are where some great stories will certainly lie. But I think maybe that's one good sign, certainly. And then sort of as we go forward, we're going to be looking at the push and pull here of how companies are going to be tightening their belts on the one side and also figuring out, okay, we can't just pull back on flexibility. What are we going to pull back on, though? The decisions they make are going to be pretty key. Are you going to get rid of that great wellness hub you launched during the pandemic? I'm not sure. Are you going to get rid of a mental health benefit? You better not. I mean, are you kidding?
Right.
But how they decide what's become a benefit, what's a perk, those decisions are going to be pretty interesting. Are they going to totally dictate whether or not people go apply for jobs there? Maybe not entirely. I mean, we still know at the end of the day, it's pay. It's the work you're doing. It's your what you see in terms of career advancement. Those are the reasons you take a job. Certainly, it's not about the bagels or but those conversations around, you know, what is your approach to flexible work? And you better not just say we're hybrid. That is the dumbest answer you can give. There are 9,000 flavors of hybrid and 8,999 of them probably don't work very well. So just saying that to a 24-year-old or, you know, somebody is not going to win them over. So you got to walk through it. How has the policy changed? Is it in writing? The things that you had to do about what is your compensation philosophy? I'm hearing so much of that from companies these days who actually have it written down. So this is our approach, overall approach to compensation and benefits, not just here's the pay range if our state requires us to post it because of pay transparency. So I think a lot of that is going to be shaping sort of how we decide where we end up working. And then the relationship, though, between bosses and workers, I mean, that's one that we're really got to keep an eye on.
Yeah, what an incredibly transformative time of convergence of all these things. And I'm picking up what you're sharing, which is it's time for organizations to get real about working through the complexities of all this and figuring out what it looks like to be successful in leading a distributed workforce in the future, because that's clearly where things are going, regardless, as you point out, Matt, of what policy an organization may have adopted. Well, I want to be mindful of our time. I'm super thankful for both of you. And I just want to say thank you for how much you've both taught me over the years. You're both leaders that I keep a close eye on in terms of you, Annie, and what you've done and what Atlassian's doing. And Matt, WorkShift has been just a fantastic resource for me and my whole team. So thank you for what you do. And thank you for spending this time with our listeners.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you for the great conversation.